I might have to re-record that.
It's gonna sound so pretty. We're gonna be like, wow, editing magic.
Hello and welcome to Snark Squad Pod, a media podcast full of friendship, feelings, and snark. My name is Nicole Sweeney.
My name is Marines, and today we are joined by Deboki.
Hi, I'm Deboki, and I am on YouTube at OkidokiBoki.
So Deboki is here to talk to us about authorial intent. Normally, this is the part where Mari would do a plot synopsis, but like there really is no synopsis. There isn't really even a trope to define here. So instead of that, a little bit of backstory on this. Mari also runs an event called BookNet Fest, and the podcast and BookNet Fest, she have had a little bit of a, I don't know, symbiotic relationship whereby Mari is doing the content for BookNet Fest, and also we're like picking ideas for these themed episodes. And sometimes we have an idea, but we don't quite know how to do it here. And this is one of those things. We actually pitched this episode like a year ago. And when we were trying to figure out what the questions would be, I could not even think of a list of questions to send to Taylor. Like, what exactly are we even talking about? And so we scrapped it, did something else instead. And so this year, when you guys are planning BookNet Fest, this just sort of wound up on the calendar. And I got a message from you saying, hey, do you want to moderate the panel on authorial intent?
That was a kind version of events, because I think it was more like you're like, hey, I'm down to do anything. And I was like, cool, remember that podcast you couldn't think of questions for? You're moderating a panel on it. Thanks, friend.
I'm really enjoying this behind the scenes look at so many things right now. It's like podcast, BookNet Fest, friendship, everything.
So now that I moderated a whole panel about authorial intent, I felt like maybe we were ready to do this as a podcast episode. Also, just on a personal note, it's one of the few panels that I was on that I didn't remember to record. So it's like lost forever. But Mari was not on that panel. Deboki was, though. So we are like reconvening a version of that panel to have this conversation about our sort of experiences with authorial intent and like authors' brands and the author's presence sort of online, mostly online, and how we feel the author's presence when we are consuming some sort of text, and also the experience of authors who are adding text even after a story is published. And here, obviously, for the purposes of this podcast, author is like, you know, showrunner, you know, beyond just books. Normally, our first question is, did you like this thing? And I don't really know, you know, like with a trope, we can usually kind of fake that question. There is truly no way for me that I can think of to fake, did you like authors having an intent? So in lieu of that, I think kind of a better like baseline question is, how does an author, and at some point I'm going to stop, an author, a storyteller, whatever, how does storyteller's brand or presence factor into your experience of taking in their work?
Okay, so this is like obviously like a really, really big question. And so like there's a lot of different ways to think about it and to like kind of figure out like what parts of an author's brand are like interesting and what parts of their intent are interesting or worth digesting or like worth engaging with. I think I've always just like found is I really love hearing authors like talk about their process. So like when authors or showrunners or anything, when they like show behind the scenes clips of what they're making, when they explain like the nitty gritty of like why things are the way they are in a book or in a movie or a TV show, I love that stuff. But like where I start to get very off track with like artists in general, I guess, is like when they start explaining the meaning of their work, because I find that so much less interesting. I'm so much less interested in what they think their work says unless it relates to that process.
I feel like that maybe the answer is a little bit different for different forms of media, like how I engage with books and the book community is different than how I engage with TV. I don't follow a single like showrunner on Twitter, for instance, but I follow a lot of authors on Twitter, which I think changes the like dynamic between me and an author and their work versus like me and a showrunner who I probably don't, you know, half the time I don't even know who that person is when I'm watching a TV show. So I think it changes a little bit for me based on what the media thing is. But also, I'm a Ravenclaw, and I mentioned this because my brand of like, I don't know, Ravenclaw and all of that like personality thing is that I like to investigate things. And there is a brief window of time pretty much after I've consumed a thing for myself and like thought up all of my own ideas where I do like to look into things like process and intent and what if there's any other media or anything else out there that will tell me like what the author thought they were doing with this piece of media. I like to read those things, and I think sometimes they can, I guess, inform how I viewed the thing, but for the most part it just lays on top like an additional piece of information that doesn't necessarily color my view of what I just consumed. If that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. For me, my interest is they're like fun facts. It's like that piece of it. It's that I like hearing more information about process. And I actually do also like hearing what, you know, the author thought that their work was doing. It's interesting to hear someone say after the fact, this is what I meant by that. And to, you know, while having the experience of, okay, but I consume that media and I never got that from it. And so like that sort of tension is always really, really interesting to me. I mean, this is part of why we are having this conversation here on this podcast, because I think that it is something that has kind of snuck into a number of our conversations. Watchmen was one place where we talked about this quite a bit. There are ways to read Watchmen that are clearly very different than what Alan Moore wants you to take away from reading Watchmen. And then, you know, there's sort of a whole separate conversation about like things that Alan Moore did with Watchmen that make me not care quite that much about what Alan Moore wants. Mm-hmm. But I consume a lot of extra stuff because I find that super interesting, but it doesn't typically factor in. And I honestly usually only seek it out when I was super into the thing, mm-hmm. whether that be, you know, a movie, a TV show, book, whatever.
I think I've been thinking about with this question, and in turn, partly just to figure out like whether or not I'm right about this, I guess, is kind of, I feel like there's these two competing things where to a certain extent, I'm like, I don't care what the author's intent was. But then like all of my reading into a book will revolve into trying to figure out what the author's intent is. And there's like this weird paradox where like I will like frame all of my thoughts in terms of like I think this is what the author intended, but then I don't actually want to hear them say anything after I'm done reading it like about what they intended. Like I think the book or the movie should stand on its own and be able to argue what like stand on its own as an argument to what the intent is.
I wonder how much of that is ingrained into us because of the way that we learn how to critique media and process media in school, because I very clearly remember that being a thing of like, what do you think the author meant? And that was kind of how we were taught how to process media. And very much so like thinking back on like, especially like poetry, like, what do you think this line means? And it was very much kind of framed around not necessarily our interpretation, but what the author meant by it.
Mm-hmm. This actually kind of transitions into the next thing that I wanted to ask, which is how participating in media critique communities and spaces online has changed that dynamic for you. And I think for me, it is really fundamental to the attitude that I, you know, brought to my initial answer of the question of like, fuck it, I don't care. I don't think that I would have had that attitude, you know, 15 years ago. I don't think that I would have felt the personal authority to say, no, this is what I read from that. And like the author, didn't effectively convey whatever the heck they wanted to say instead.
Yeah.
Whereas I now feel like having had the experience of, you know, all of my many years of online fandom and especially all of the experience with Snark Squad, you know, we've been doing this for over 8 years now. And like, that's a lot of time spent thinking about what all of these different TV shows and books and whatnot are saying. And it has made me feel like these conversations are just so much more interesting to me than what this one person thought that they were saying. Like, you had your chance to say the thing, and I'm grateful that you said the thing. I don't mean that to be like, you know, I don't mean for this to come across as like fuck you, bye, but yeah. It is a thing that you said. As a storyteller, you said your thing. You said your piece by telling this story. And so the, I don't know, critical conversation about what it means and what it's meant to do, I don't think that the author can't be a part of that. But I also think that there's a weird sort of privileging of the author's perspective. And so for me, it's easier to just like leave them out of it entirely, you know, because I think that in, especially in fan communities, right, there's a very strong deference to whatever the author said in some fan communities, I guess. My preference is to just disregard and say, okay, like they said their thing. Now everybody circle up. What did you think?
I think that's really interesting because separate things are happening there for me personally. And one is definitely that I feel like in these last 8 years that we've been doing Snark Squad, I've definitely found my voice as like a media critic. And that has gone through several, I don't know, evolutions, I guess, of like, you know, figuring out, like, I think I started with this very defined idea of what it meant to like criticize media and like what was right and wrong about it, where now we've very much reached that point where it's like, I don't know, did you enjoy it? Did you like it? And it's less like black and white than when I started. But I've also found that like authority that I granted myself to have these opinions online and like what I like and don't like what I don't like and read things the way that I want to read them. So I think that that is definitely one portion of it. But I think that because part of criticizing media online is doing so for an audience, we've had to have interactions with a lot of different fandoms, whether we considered ourselves part of them or not. And a lot of times, like you're saying, it's not only that like the author's intent is prioritized, but it is almost sometimes weaponized.
Yeah.
And so a lot of times, like coming across that, like the weaponization of canon or the author's intent has meant that I, in turn, keep taking steps back away from it. Like, if this is the way that you're going to wield it, like, I'm not going to engage with that at all. Like, I'm just going to stay over here in my corner where I've granted myself the authority to feel how I want.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, like, especially, like, even like outside of media criticism, fandom has really made that a huge thing for people. Like, if you disagree with the way that an author has written a book, you can write another version of the book. You can write a different version of the character. And like, yeah, technically maybe it's not correct in the way that it's not canon, but like, who's to say canon's correct? Like, anything can happen. It's just like it's just a story, and there are other versions of that story that you can make happen.
So that's a really interesting point, because my next sort of big question that I want to ask you guys is what your relationship is with canon. And I think part of how I answered this question in general, just like my feelings on authorial intent, are very wrapped up in how I feel about canon specifically. But I'm curious what your relationship is with the idea of canon.
I think canon is just like one universe among many. And like, sometimes that's stressful. Like, sometimes when I read comic books, like, it's hard because there are so many universes. But I think in terms of consuming media, consuming it with that in mind has made it way easier, because it's like, you know, I read Harry Potter and there's a universe of canon for Harry Potter. And then there are many other universes that have been created by fandom. And there have also been many universes that have been created by me restricting the amount of input that J.K. Rowling is allowed to have into canon now. Like, I have just created like barriers, like to keep it to what is useful to me as like a fan. Like, useful is a weird word, but like, yeah, just like what's actually fun for me and what's worth engaging in.
I think useful is a totally good and appropriate word in this context. I think when you're talking about your relationship with media, like, yeah, I think it's totally fair to talk about what actually feels useful in that relationship.
I would agree that my relationship with like authorial intent is very heavily wrapped up in canon. But to that end, both of those things are super complicated for me, because like, personally, I have a strong relationship with canon. I am a type of person, like, you guys know how much I love Pride and Prejudice, right? And I have no interest in reading fan fiction. I have no interest in reading any sort of, like, Mr. Darcy's diary, the point of view of somebody else, or somebody else came into this universe to play. I don't care. I honestly don't. And yeah. I'm not assigning worth there. Like, if you care, that is awesome for you, but I just give zero shits about anything outside of what Jane Austen has put up, down on paper. And so that is kind of how I carry myself forward. And I think that also in being a media critic, and because we've had some of the experiences that we've had, specifically I'm thinking about Buffy and entering into that space, we had to almost stick very strictly to canon because people wanted to come and, like, fight us, not, you know, I'm using that as an expression, but kind of fight us based on their own, like, headcanons. And I'm very, very happy that you have that, but that's not an even playing field, because that exists solely in your head. That is not somewhere where I can engage, because it is not something that was given to me by anything other than you deciding that it was true right now. So when it comes to, like, putting things online, I think that there is a line that you have to toe pretty closely to canon in order to have certain conversations. But then you get things like J.K. Rowling and what she's doing, but that also sort of falls back into this idea that, like, outside of the end in her books, I don't care. I don't care what else she has to say.
Your Twitter is not part of the published Harry Potter novels.
I think about this in the context of, like, my own fandom, because a lot of my favorite ships are enemies to lovers kind of ships. And I can only engage in those ships if I disregard the text, right? Like,
it drives me nuts. Like,
and I think that's totally fair. But and so, like, as someone who comes to fandom with a lot of these ships, it is a weird factor of, like, reading people's commentary. Like, I erase the text for, like, reading fan fiction, but, like, if I'm reading the book itself, my reaction is different, because I know that, like, in the context of this specific work, like, I can't erase those actions. Like, Spike is an awful person. Like, he does terrible things, and I can't, like, erase that from, like, the actual context of the show. It's just in the context of my other fandom, then I have to be like, well, I'm going to pretend that these three episodes didn't happen or something, like, or that they happened differently. And I think it's a weird tension. And I don't, like, I sometimes feel more, like, with some things, I feel more uncomfortable with it than with others.
Yeah, this is very interesting. I have very conflicted feelings. One, because I also lived through that experience of recapping Buffy. It's the thing we can't fucking stop talking about. It is hilarious to me, because I remember years ago when we were, like, halfway through the project, Murray and I see each other every April, and the first time this happened, we were, like, halfway through recapping Buffy, and we were talking about it, and we had just gotten a comment that was, like, something about, you know, what else do you guys think about it? It was, like, asking for more probing thoughts. And we were laughing about it, because we were like, we literally never think about this outside of when we're writing the recaps. Like, I only think about Buffy. I sit down, I write my 3,000 words, and then I move the fuck on with my life.
Yep.
But then a year later, like, because of all of this stuff, like, recapping season 6, basically, once we had were, you know, very far into 6, maybe even close to 7, I think we wrapped in the spring, so we would have been just about done. The next time we met up, it was like the only fucking thing we talked about. We spent our entire like reunion lunch was just talking
our
about
vacation.
Buffy. Yes, and now here we are, all these years later, and we still bring it up on, like, every fucking topical episode of this podcast.
Well, and I think it's so relevant for this one, because it is, I feel like Buffy is one of the first shows that I remember being so closely tied to the showrunner. I don't know historically if that's true. That's just, like, for me and my memory, we're like, it's like, oh, this is a Joss Whedon show. And it's, like, very hard to separate, like, a lot of that universe. It's really hard for me to separate from the fact that, like, Joss Whedon is, like, a vast majority of the creative force that made this show happen. And like, for me, like in terms of authorial intent, like that has shaped the way that I've consumed this universe. It's part of why I haven't been able to finish Angel, even though I know that it's supposed to be really good, just because there's a lot of things in terms of how he writes women that I know are inevitably going to make me mad when I watch Angel, even if I know that this show is supposed to be good overall. It's just really hard for me to separate that from him. And some of the things that have come out about him, like more recently.
Really good is very strong.
Yeah. So.
Okay. I'm willing to accept that because I probably won't be able to finish it. So
the Joss Whedon factor is also really interesting to me, because that is one of the many questions that contributed to our original sort of idea behind having this conversation, because it's also a question of how you navigate a work that is made by somebody who sucks and like how do you engage with that? And I think for a lot of us, it's been fairly easy to say, maybe like going forward, I'm not gonna like check out any new stuff from person who sucks. But, you know, I watched Buffy and I had this whole relationship with Buffy before I knew that Joss Whedon sucked. So it can be very tricky to like make that call. And I think it tends to be pretty personal. I'm curious what your experiences have been with making that call.
Again, complicated, I think, because especially as you're talking about, like, in retrospect, looking at something like, not Buffy, I have a very mixed relationship with, but Firefly is like one of my favorite things ever, also created by Joss Whedon. So, and I recently rewatched it, and while his like stamp of not being great to women is also on that, like, it's still something that is in my feelings. So kind of putting that all together is very tricky, but like moving forward, when I find out like beforehand, if somebody is garbage and I know they're garbage and their work is coming out, I think it's very tricky for things like movies, where like a director, for instance, is one of many people who are involved in making a movie, versus like a book that was written by one trash person, and like how much of that directly like affects them and goes into their pocket. Because for me, it's less about like, you're a trash person and I'm being, I don't know, like petty about this, I guess, and more about like, I have limited resources and time and money, and I would like to put that to better use. And so my only way of like really letting the publisher know, or letting the author know, that we don't want these trash things is not giving it my time or money. So that's how I tend to look at that decision, versus any sort of like moral necessarily, like I'm taking a stance here. It's more like I'm putting my limited resources where they count better and where I feel better about doing so.
Definitely. And it's like, he, like, maybe someone's bad at writing women, and then the actress who's playing her will like do something that like will at least make the character, even if you're frustrated with the writing of her, like will still endear you to the character, or like make you like make something about her resonate with you or something along those lines. And that's, yeah, that's where it gets so muddied for so many people. And I feel like, at least to me, I feel like my responsibility is to like never ignore that. Like, if there's something I care about in a character, but there's also all of these caveats that I feel about it, like, I don't ever want to like just be like, well, those don't matter. Like, they're still there. They just might be registering for me differently.
I have a specific example of this, of like how in retrospect something was completely different, and it is a place where like author's trash behavior kind of made me question their intent, and it is Juno Diaz. Very important and popular Dominican American author, and I absolutely loved his work. But in a lot of his work, he really, I thought, was exploring like how there can be a lot of machismo and misogyny in Latinx cultures. And for me, when I was reading it, because he was pointing these things out, I thought that he was like in on it. I thought he was like on this side of it, looking also at this misogyny. And then there were allegations, and, you know, I guess I have to, I'm not sure where that ended up, because again, when the allegations came out, I was just like, okay, done, because that's all I really need to make my decision personally. But there were allegations against him and his behavior against other women in the publishing community. And then that colored what I thought of what he was doing in his books. If he was behaving in ways that were similar to the ways that his main male characters were, suddenly he's not in on it with me. Is he condoning it? Like, did he know that he wrote what he wrote? And yeah. Or was it just like, you know, normal behavior for him and his character, the way that he wrote it? And I was reading into it like, oh, look at that misogyny, you know? So it really changed the way I looked at it. And so that has completely changed my experience of his books and made it so that I don't want to read the ones that I haven't read yet, because I don't know, it's different.
Yeah. That's a tough one to follow, because that's such a like spot on example.
Yeah.
In that it's something that you loved about the work is also present in like why this person sucks. And so like that
yeah.
That sort of dynamic.
Yeah, and like undermined by it.
Yeah. Yes. That's what I was trying to say. Yeah, that sort of dynamic, I think, is very it's a little too on the nose, honestly.
No, thank you.
Actually abandoned this canon conversation midway because I got distracted by Joss Whedon. So
don't we all?
Veered off course, but to circle back to that, part of where it gets really tricky is to Mari's point about like having conversations online, where we always on Snark Squad had to come from the place of we are approaching this with canon as the only information and like that's all we have and whatever, versus, you know, when you're like deep into fandom spaces, it's like assumed and understood that people are playing in all of their sort of other universes. And you have, I'm going to keep borrowing DeBokey's lovely phrasing, but like you have all of those universes kind of overlapping and sitting on top of each other. And like, you know, if you go on a place like Tumblr, all like they are literally just all happening at once, all of the different mm-hmm. universes, like people who are strictly canon, people who are whatever. Like if you go through the tags for a particular fandom, it's all happening at once. And that can be it can be really tricky to figure out what everybody is talking about and to sort of get on the same page about how you are treating this particular work. At the same time, even here, like even on Snark Squad, as we were making our way through the A Song of Ice and Fire books, we got late in those books, like that last episode, the book five episode, you know, I shouldn't say the last episode, maybe one day George will finish another fucking book, but the book five, oh, and especially the A Knight of the Seven Kingdoms episode, we veered off into all sorts of weird, like, you know, fandom and headcanon-y stuff, in part because we had spent so much time with this material and like picking over this material and obsessing over this material that it felt like it felt more fun to go off and, you know, like do the sandbox thing. And also because, you know, there were pieces of it that we like weren't happy with. And so it was, again, more fun to go off and do the sandbox thing. And so I don't know. This is my very long-winded, rambly way of saying that I find it really hard to have a concrete answer to that question, because I think that it is always going to be context dependent, and that context can literally change like in the moment, you know, that like as you are having a conversation with someone, it can slide and like suddenly, like originally you were talking about here's what actually happened in this scene, but then now I'm talking about here's what would have been fun instead.
Yeah, I remember like in early days of the TV show discourse around Game of Thrones, like I like have been like a long-term Sansa apologist, but it's like, or like not even apologist, cheerleader, but it was based largely on where I wanted her character to go, not things that had happened in the text yet. And it's weird having that argument with people and then being like, oh right, you don't have like the version of her in your head that I have, like because you haven't been like going down this road.
And I think the tricky part is that a lot of these conversations often intertwine, and I'm totally for conversations like who should Dany have ended up with, or how who should Sansa have ended up with, and we all can like add our pieces of those conversations, and headcanon plays largely in there. But I think that sometimes the conversations we have and the ones that we were having were not necessarily that. And it is that kind of like realizing like, my version of a character like Spike is probably not the version that somebody else is considering when they're like, he's so dreamy, because my version is the one that I actually saw on screen.
Definitely.
You know, I don't even want to talk about it. I'm like, I don't even want to. But, you know, I saw him on screen behaving the way that he did. And that is, you know, because I am built the way that I am and I engage with this particular piece of media the way that I did. That's the only version of him that I have in my head. But I think that it's also worth like noting that when you're trying to have like conversations about the character, you have to start at some kind of even playing ground or playing field. And that is usually canon. Like I can't engage with you in your headspace of all of the things that you have either like erased or enhanced or made better about this character, because that is so specific to you. The only place that we can kind of come together and have this conversation is around what happened. And we can interpret those things differently for sure. And I'm not taking that away from anybody. We can interpret what we saw differently, but it has to start with like what the show put forth.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting too to consider like how you're, you know, we talked about relationship with authorial intent kind of being personal and changing media to media. But I think it's also like interesting to think about how it changes when you enjoy a piece of media versus when you don't enjoy a piece of media. Like, I think that for some people, like really loving a universe means they want to go play in that sandbox. Whereas for other people, really hating it is what triggers them to be like, no, that was like bad. Like, I want to go make it better. And even coming from like those opposing points of view and like stepping into a fandom, I think is really interesting.
We had joked in the early days of this podcast about adding a like fanfic corner segment to the podcast. Do you remember this? That this was an idea that we had. This was briefly a thing that we had toyed with. And it was basically from the perspective of mostly when a thing was bad, like rounding out the podcast. Borrowing from our friend Nick has a podcast called Real Bad, and borrowing from his sort of one of his final segments is like, how would we fix this movie? And related to that, essentially, you know, what would be, what's the fun fan fiction that you want to see written about this story or thing or whatever? Because I think that is, for me, much more where I have the impulse. Like, if something was bad about it, then I'm like, okay, wait, do this instead. Whereas if it was good, I'm like, oh, no, you did it. You did the thing. I am content now because I enjoyed the book or the movie or whatever. Like, good job. A+.
I mean, that was like me and Bridge to Terabithia when I was little, where I was like, at the end of this book, no one died.
The end.
My earliest forays into like fan fiction, apparently, were like when I was 7 and was like devastated.
Who, I think this was somebody at BookNetFest, was talking about having read Little Woman, but only partially as a kid, and then like growing up and reading the whole book and feeling incredibly betrayed because they had thought that the abridged version that they read was the whole thing. Speaking of BookNetFest, the thing that sort of took over this whole panel when we had this conversation there that I now want to put to you guys is, what kind of experiences have you had with authors or storytellers adding additional context to their story after the story is, to your knowledge, as you thought it was, over?
And by authors, you mean J.K. Rowling. I think this panel became like an hour-long therapy session for like Harry Potter fans.
It's a really interesting time to be having this conversation. I mean, it always is. Why am I like even saying that? Because J.K. Rowling makes like a headline every week. But they recently like relaunched Pottermore as Wizarding World, I guess, to like really drive home the fact that she's going to keep on adding like content into this larger world. And they you could take like the sorting quiz again. And so I feel like every so often this thing gets relaunched or whatnot. I know this is only like sort of related, but then you have people freaking out on yes. their timelines because they did not get the thing that they wanted, which of course always reminds me of Nicole and her thesis.
What is this? I wrote a whole fucking paper about this. I have so many feelings.
About sorting quizzes?
Yes. Well, specifically about this dynamic and this question, like this question of authorial intent as it relates to the sorting hat. The idea, like when Pottermore first launched and I was in grad school, the beta testing happened during my first semester of grad school. And so a lot of like hardcore Harry Potter fans were posting these reaction videos of them being sorted into not where they wanted to be sorted. And to me at the time, I had not actually read all the Harry Potter books. I had seen the movies and that was it. And so to me, this is like early days, early, I don't know, entry point into the fandom is watching all of these videos in which people almost universally say the way that I have self-identified for a formative decade of my life is now erased because an author told me that I should identify this way instead. And I still find that bananas. Like I find that as a concept wild. And I like the whole time I was doing it, like I kept waiting for, there's one girl who was in my like little sample or whatever, who did actually say like, fuck this, I am not a Hufflepuff. And then, but I looked at her channel, her next video is her, like she has all new swag and she's like, you know, it's true. I am a Hufflepuff after all. No.
Oh my God.
And it like, I've been sitting here most of this like conversation being like, I don't know, like canon is important and I understand authorial intent, but here's the place where I want to grant you the authority.
Yes.
To go and be happy in your own like self-identification and mm-hmm. your own like vision yeah. of yourself in this universe. Because again, just like the freaking out of like, and the thing is that it's like not a one-time thing. This did not stop when right. it launched. She keeps yeah. adding and they keep changing. And every time people have a crisis.
Yes.
And it turns out if you just unfollow her, your sense of identity never changes.
Right. Like, listen, J.K. Rowling does not know you. She does not care about you. Like, yeah.
I guess the other part of this too is like, you know, that she in a more concrete way, I guess, keeps adding like details that color her story or yes. details to her world where, you know, yeah. the one that has absolutely scarred me for life and I could probably talk to a therapist about is like the pooping thing, the pooping at Hogwarts thing. Like why did we need that?
Yep.
Yeah, and I think like one of the more nefarious ones almost, it's sort of the way that like watching the way that she's been trying to tackle the race issues or like the diversity yeah. issues in her work after Harry Potter, where you're kind of just like, I can see you're trying, and now I like almost miss when you didn't try. Like, there's probably a lot to say there about intent. It's just kind of like after a certain point, I'm just like, I think I will engage with the set part of J.K. Rowling that I have made my peace with. Like, I grew up on those books. I loved those books. I still love those books. But like, I know based on what the text says that there's a lot of things I have issues with. And at this point, she's not going to be able to fix them by putting out a new movie. She's not going to be able to address them very well with a tweet. She's probably going to make it worse. So like, I am just going to engage with this part of her and like, I don't need the rest of it.
DeBokey also made a really great video talking about a lot of things, but at the tail end elaborates on this, this idea, which we will link in the show notes. I also think about this in terms of like additional material that comes out in the universe that is done then like technically canon, but it's weird because, you know, the thing was over, we were done. And so I've mentioned a bunch of times that I never watched anything of Veronica Mars past the first three seasons. And like, because I was it. That was, you know, like I watched it and everything that I saw about the movie, like the movie looked like a giant fan service project and that's cool. I bought it. I also am a big fan, but I the very particular sort of attachment that I feel for Veronica, you know, like she graduated in 2006. I graduated in 2006. Like there's, you know, like she's like my age, right? Or she's supposed to be my age. And so for me in my mid 20s, the idea of being forced into a box dreamt up by my 19-year-old self, like sucked. I did not like it and I did not want it. And I still very much feel that way. And so I just have this very weird relationship with this show that I absolutely love. It's still one of my favorite shows, but I am totally fine with saying this is one of my favorite shows and I have not seen anything past these first three seasons. I will continue to keep watching them. I will eventually one day for Snark Squad finish it. Who knows when? But like for me, I got to a place where like that is canon. And I don't, it's not that like I deny that the rest of the canon exists, but like I guess maybe it is like a little bit, you know, in my heart, the canon stopped. And then like past that point, it's just whatever the heck. I dream that Veronica gets the fuck out of Neptune and then just like goes and off and has her own separate life that is not incredibly wrapped up in all of these traumas. And that is what she is up to in my sort of headcanon. And I don't really need the rest of it, but I don't know. It's just weird to know that an author has like come back to reopen something that felt closed.
Yeah, like reopening a wound.
And I don't know if this again is like heavily tied to personal like enjoyment, but also like feeling like a story is closed, but and also maybe distance like between the end of a thing. Like for instance, we recently covered Fleabag and that is like two seasons and done. And if they had reopened that, I'd be like, heck yeah, let's visit, like, let's do some more. But I don't know if that's because it's fresh enough. Whereas if like, you know, 10 years later, after I've made my peace with the end of the show, they were like, and here's some more, if I would feel differently about it. I don't know. And it's also difficult for me because I'm really bad at finishing series. And so, like, the amount of, like, I don't care past when I feel like I have a personal ending versus, like, oh, maybe I care, but I'm also really bad and have a short attention span and I'm not going to pick it up anyways. Like, those two things are very mixed up in my head. With Veronica Mars, I've watched the movie, I've not read any of the books, I haven't watched the new season, so it's like very patchy.
My other kind of big example of a sort of favorite thing being revisited after it was over is the His Dark Materials books. Philip Pullman has released a number of shorter things since the completion of the trilogy, but he just recently started a sort of new trilogy, which I thought was going to be entirely a prequel trilogy. And I read the first book just recently, and it is my understanding that the second book is actually after. So the first book is Lyra is a baby, but then the second book in this new trilogy is going to be her as an adult. And I'm excited about that, just like because now I'm like in it and I'm curious, but I'm also sort of anxious about it. And so I think going back to this question, I think it's ultimately a case by case kind of thing. I think it has a lot to do with the relationship that you have with the thing. And also kind of back to the main point, I think your relationship with the author is a factor too. So reading this prequel book was frustrating to me because it painted a version of Lord Asriel who cares a lot more about Lyra than the version of Lord Asriel that we saw in the trilogy. Everything else about this book, I will say, I actually thoroughly enjoyed. It was a fun book. I'm not going to lie. I did like this book a lot. However, every time Lord Asriel showed up, I mean, he was still like, he's still not like father of the year, but he just seemed invested in Lyra in a way that was baffling to me because the Lord Asriel of the novels basically seems invested in her mostly because his pride is sort of attached to her. You know, he takes care of her to the degree that his pride mandates that he must. And beyond that, he kind of doesn't give a shit. And also, he's a murderer. So, like, fuck this guy. And I hate him. That got away from me.
Another example I was thinking of is Star Wars, because, like, Star Wars has come back multiple times in many different iterations. And, like, so there's the first trilogy, does really well. Then we get the second or prequel trilogy, does really badly. And now we have this new many things happening that have, like, had varying degrees of success, but also have involved, I guess, like, I don't know enough, but, like, technically erasing, like, a lot of the canon from books and stuff in between, which is kind of like what some of what you were saying kind of reminded me of, just in terms of how, like, fandom is sort of engaged with that and how, yeah, all of these things now kind of change the way people interact with different parts of the story.
I think that some of what we're talking about is why I want to like, but often struggle with, like, comic book stories. Because a lot of times they just, like, inherently erase their own canon and they're like, I don't know, let's start again. And I'm like, what? You can't. We just need to start over again. Like, and I think that you just have to have a level of buy-in for, like, closing off a story and, like, starting it all over again that I like, personally cannot. But I keep trying. I'm looking at, like, my shelf of comic books that I'm still like, okay, this is it. I'm going to try again. It never quite happens. For me.
Yeah.
Those are particularly interesting too, because even though they are constantly sort of resetting their own canon, they're also relying on emotional investment from, you know, your previous experiences with the story. And that is a very interesting example, which I also don't have enough context for to really comment on. But my one last little thing that I want to shout out, I said last episode that I was definitely going to talk about Emily Nussbaum's I Like to Watch in this episode, and I never did, partially because we basically talked about her bad fan stuff without me ever needing to talk about it directly. So, but I am going to link one of her many pieces that she's written about the idea of the bad fan in the show notes of this episode. I also want to, like, just sort of quickly shout out her book, because to the conversation we were having about how you make the decision about when to sort of personally cancel a storyteller, there is a very long chapter, presumably there is also a corresponding piece published somewhere, about her grappling with her teenage love of Woody Allen and, like, sort of post Me Too and just all of that. Obviously, like, it's Woody Allen was a known piece of shit, like, pre Me Too, but still, it's really, really interesting to hear her kind of talk through how she thought about that and how her thinking about all of that changed. I don't know, it's great. The whole book is great. If you like this podcast, I swear to God, you will like this book. Anyway.
If you don't like this podcast, right? If you don't like this podcast, you still might like that book.
That's true. I mean, I don't know why you, we're like at the end of the episode now, but I don't know why you're still listening. Maybe you don't like to be happy. And on that note, that brings us to the end of another episode of the podcast. Thank you all for listening. And thank you so much to Deboki for joining us. If you're enjoying this podcast, we would love it if you consider joining our community on Patreon at patreon.com/snarksquad. We would love to hear all of your thoughts. There will be a post dedicated to this episode up on snarksquad.com, or you can find us all on Twitter at snark_squad. You can find me at Sweeney Says.
I'm at My Name is Madiness.
And I'm at okidoki_boki.
Thank you, as always, to Stefan Jin for the theme music that is playing us out right now, and we will be back in your feed again next week. Bye.
Bye.